Are you listening to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other platform where you can leave a rate or review? Do you like what we're doing? If the answer to all of that is yes, please consider quickly giving us a 5-star rate. And if you wouldn't mind leaving us a nice review, we greatly appreciate that as well. Okay, let's do this.
Hello, welcome to the Ghosts of Harrenhal. My name's Simon.
And I'm McKelly.
Thank you for joining us for episode 208 of our chapter-by-chapter book review of A Song of Ice and Fire by George Martin. Today, we'll be discussing chapter 64 of A Storm of Swords. That's John 8.
And as always, we're going to chat about the chapter, and we're going to try not to spoil any future plot points for you. And hopefully, we're going to provide you some entertainment along the way.
We'll summarise what happened, discuss our thoughts on it, provide some useful background, compare it to the television show, indulge in a little pedantry and cover some relevant news and listener correspondence. Be sure to check out the show notes, they'll provide some additional information about the characters and other things of note in this chapter. How are you, McKelly?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing pretty well. You know, I was talking to Ethan right before I came down here to record, and he said, "Are you nervous?" And I was like, that thought never even crossed my mind to be nervous.
I understand why you said that, but I have a cold sweat dripping down my back right now.
Because of all our technical difficulties?
Technical issues at the wazoo. I thought we were not going to be able to get this done, but
yeah.
Thank you, internet. You got us out of this pickle.
Right. What a weird setting. It was just some weird random Windows setting.
I've never touched before in my life, but it had set itself in opposition to all that I wanted from my computer. Yeah, so there's a very interesting word in our witty banter in the notes. I'm curious what that's about.
The word doppelganger?
Exactly.
Is that the word? Well, so Ethan and his friend went to the mall 2 days ago, and they brought Molly with them. And for some reason, they were driving and talking about...
They brought back a different Molly.
Right, yes. I was like, that looks just like her, but that's not her. I know what she looks like. That's not her. Something came up, and they put up a picture of a celebrity. And Molly said, "Oh, yeah, he kind of looks like Dad." And
oh, was it John Krasinski?
It was not John Krasinski. I was going to ask you to guess, but then I was afraid of what your guesses might be.
you are inviting trouble, that's for sure. So who was it?
The answer to the question was Channing Tatum.
Channing Tatum, okay.
Magic Mike, he's like 20 years younger than me. Super buff. So Ethan had to call me. He calls me. It just hysterics. And he's like, we showed Molly a picture of Channing Tatum and she said, "Yeah, it kind of looks like Dad." And I was like, yes, she is right. Very astute observation, my daughter.
Which one of the two of you do you think is winning favor at this point, Ethan?
Exactly.
Her or you?
Oh, so I thought Stacey thought that was absurd. I thought that was a very astute observation by my youngest.
Yes, clearly she's correct. So I've torn my hamstring playing soccer and I'm out of soccer for 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
I'm very depressed about this, but
yeah,
when you get to my age and you run too fast on the soccer field, it's kind of going to happen eventually. But I did have an extremely funny conversation on the family call last weekend.
Oh, perfect. We love those.
Yes, yes. So my mother was giving us an interminable story about the parks and rec basically refusing to cut a hedge. They would cut the hedge, but only on the park side of the hedge, but the hedge was in the park.
Oh,
so they wouldn't cut the outside face of it. And my mum was like, "No, you've got to." And she, this story, my God, I have just summarized 30 minutes. Yeah, it was really, it went on and on. So she got into this row with him. And eventually when she finished, I said, "Mum, how long is this hedge?" And she said, "Oh, it's taller than me." I said, no, Mum. To be clear, my mum is, you know, she's in her 80s and she doesn't really care what you're saying. So there's a combination of not hearing you very well and not really caring anyway. So I repeated the question. No, no, Mum, how long is it? And she said, I'd probably need a stepladder to get all the way up there. I'm like, no, Mum.
You're going the wrong direction.
How long is it? And finally she said, oh, it's the length of the allotment. I don't know what the allotment is. I'm like, what are you talking about? So I turned to my sister, who lives locally, and I said, Lucy, how long is this hedge? And she said, well, you know the two new bungalows that were built since you left? I'm like, No.
I do not.
Like, right, both of you, just listen. There are these things called units that you can measure things in. You don't have to compare it to other objects. You can just tell me in... Choose feet? Your unit. Feet, meters, whatever you feel like, you know.
Even inches. Do the math.
Rob was cracking up at my increasing ire and frustration, trying to get a sense of how long this hedge was. It turned out it was about 40 meters. Someone finally came up with a number, which is maybe 130 feet, something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm glad you did that math for me, because I would not necessarily have known.
But... That was a sort of like just a quintessence of that call and how frustrating and stupid it can be.
That's good stuff. How long is it? Well, it's about as long as the space that it's in.
Yeah, exactly. The same length as the wall that it climbs over. God, they were cracking me up. So, the other thing, you know, I like wordplay.
I do.
I still remember the day that I said synecdoche on the podcast, and the Discord server went berserk with "What is wrong with you, man?"
And meanwhile, like I thought you were talking about a town in New York.
In New York, yes, yeah. Exactly, yeah. But so today. We were trying to come up with a label that we could put on certain tickets at work. And the label was supposed to describe something that was being taken out of support early compared to the support policy.
Okay.
And so I mentioned it to my team. I said, we need a label for this. And they all got off on a tangent of like discussing a cool and funny label for this thing. Meanwhile, I was talking to the person who wanted this and we were being a bit more serious. And we came up with proposed support end date or something like that. And we just said, all right, that's what we're going to do. I went back to my team and they've come up with dead before its time was their choice. So I told them, no, we're going with this. I said, but thanks for your efforts. And one of them came back and said, well, yeah, we'll go with that, but it's not as good as Dead Before Its Time. And then it occurred to me, so Dead Before Its Time never got a chance at life, that it itself was dead before its time.
Oh, right. Yes.
And then I wondered if there was a word to describe a word that is an example of the thing that it represents.
Oh, wow.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I'm going to need a flowchart for that one.
And the same person... came straight back. He said, that's an example of autologic, or it's an autological word. A word that is an example of the thing it describes is autological. The quintessential example is polysyllabic. The word polysyllabic means having many syllables.
Right.
Polysyllabic has many syllables. It is an example of a polysyllabic word.
Right. I follow.
Yeah, but there are other examples. The word word. Word is a word and is also the word for word.
Right, yes. It's
so
a word,
it is an example of the thing, of the concept that it represents, you see.
Yeah, good stuff.
And then the other one that I liked, I liked Hellenic. Hellenic meaning of Greek origin. Where do we get the word Hellenic from? Well, it's from the Greek, Helleniki, meaning Greece. So... it itself is of Greek origin, so it's autological.
I see.
You're loving this now, aren't you?
Yeah, you learn more than just A Song of Ice and Fire information on this show.
And my favorite one of all, let me see. Yes, here we go. Are you ready for this one?
Yeah.
Proparoxetone. Proparoxetone.
Sounds like a medicine of some kind.
Oh, yeah, it does sound like a medicine. It's not, actually. And you have to say it the way I said it. You can't say proparoxetone. You have to say proparoxetone.
Proparoxetone. Yeah?
Because it means you put the stress on the syllable two from the end of the word.
That's what that word means.
That's what that word means.
And if you pronounce it just right.
But apparently that is how you're supposed to pronounce it. So it is an example of itself, you know. So proparoxetone. So if you... it's stress on the antepenultimate or third to last. I would say second to last syllable, but what I read said third to last. I mean, to me, you have last, next to last, and second to last.
I could see that. I could see your logic there.
But anyway, the antepenultimate or second to last syllable. So proparoxetone.
Wow.
All right.
I feel smarter. I'm going to go out into the world and try and use some of these.
Well, the thing is, I'm riding coattails. My guy was straight in. I said, is there a word for it? And he came back straight away and said, the word you're looking for is autologic. I was like,
okay.
You know more than me. All right, enough of this frivolity. Let's get down to business.
Let's do it.
How do we leave Jon Snow? So last we saw of Jon, he was fighting to defend Castle Black from his former comrades in the Wildling raiding party. Despite significant losses, the Wildlings were defeated. The stairs up the wall were sacrificed in the battle. And of course, Ygritte died in his arms. Mm. So McKellie, why don't we give the summary of this one? Bound to be happier than that one.
Yes, let's hope so. Well, Jon is dreaming of Winterfell. He walks through the crypts, and his stone ancestors accuse him of being no Stark and having no place here. He calls out to his father, to Bran, to Rickon, but there's no answer. Above, he can hear a feast, at which he is not welcome. His crutch slips out, and he falls. A light has gone out, and now he calls out to Ygritte. He begs her for forgiveness, but it turns out he's talking to a direwolf.
We'll be right back.
Hello, friends. Are you ready to make some unforgettable memories? Well, if so, consider the Marriott Bonvoy program. Discover the perfect destination for your summer getaway and unlock exclusive deals on luxurious accommodations. With our affiliate partnership, you'll enjoy unbeatable savings and a seamless booking experience. Don't let summer slip away. Visit Marriott Bonvoy today and make this vacation season one for the books. Use our Ghosts of Harrenhal affiliate page to check it all out and buy Bonvoy points or give some as a gift. The link to our page is in the show notes.
He wakes in his own bed in the steward's cell beneath Mormont's chambers. No comfort there. Cold. No ghost. No Ygritte. Could the wolf in his dream be ghost dead? But no, he looked more like summer. Does this mean that Bran is truly lost to him now? The Night's Watch horn sounds twice. Wildlings. He dresses quickly and heads out.
The only way up the wall is the cage winch, but it's already on its way up when Jon arrives. He and several of his brothers await its return. It's very cold. Clytus and Hob feed and water the troops while they wait. Sadden asks if it's Mance Rayder. Jon tells him to hope so. There are worse things north of the wall. It's colder still atop the wall. Fires burn and ammunition is plentiful. They hear mammoths, but they can't see anything. Noy fires burning barrels of pitch from two trebuchets to light up the enemy. By the light, hundreds of mammoths are spotted. It's a raiding group at the gate, the only conceivable way through for the wildlings.
Three iron gates and a 9-inch thick oak door block the way. Murder holes will make any invader pay a fearful price. Acting Commander Noy heads down to the tunnel with a few men, leaving Jon in charge on the wall. Now the night wears on in a blur of arrows, burning oil, and trebuchet fire. John's exhausted and in a trance with the repetition. His fever returns, and the combination of his wounded leg and burned fingers make the constant archery a painful misery.
Even John, who had seen the wildling army, is stunned by the numbers at daybreak. All the wildlings in the world had descended upon them. The sight threatens to unman the young brothers, but John rouses them with a stirring speech, featuring the not unreasonable point that they literally can't hurt us. We're 700 feet above them. He targets a battering ram that is headed for the gate.
The onslaught of arrows stops the ram, and the wounded mammoths run amok. The wildlings withdraw. John rides down to check on the tunnel and leaves Gren in charge on the wall. After the previous battle, the temptation had been to leave the debris of the stairs to block the tunnel, but Noi had insisted it be cleared. Wise now, as the giants and mammoths would have broken through. Now John goes down to find that Mag the Mighty himself had destroyed the outer door and had bent the bars on the first iron gate and reached through to kill the defenders. But Donal Noi had killed the King of the Giants with his own final act.
John walks through to the outer entrance and looks upon the devastation. He comes back in and decrees that they must fill the tunnel with as much debris as possible. He wants to tell Sir Winton Stout, who should be next in command, but Maester Aemon tells him that he, John, must take on the leadership until Bowen Marsh returns. Sir Winton's wits are long gone, and the Night's Watch needs a true leader. It is what Mormont intended when he made him his steward. John is incredulous. You know, I was just thinking, while we were reading this, that if someone had asked your mom, so how long is the wall? She'd say, it's about the width of Westeros.
She'd be like, well, there's 17 castles, so it's like 17 times the distance between two castles. Oh, thanks, Mom. That's cleared that up.
Really
cleared that up. But no, Mom, how long is it? She's like, oof, it'd take you all day to climb it.
It is much taller than I am.
Yeah. We're in the discussion part of our notes now, and I left the first sentence from the last John chapter, which read, this is the first in-person battle we've seen in a while. And so I left it in because this is the second battle we've seen. We just have to wait for the next John chapter. They're coming thick and fast.
Apparently so. We were talking about, you and I were discussing this chapter a little bit earlier in the day, and we both came to the conclusion that this chapter doesn't really advance the plot much at all. I guess after the last John chapter, it was a matter of when would Mance show up, and now it's a matter of Mance has shown up.
Yeah. Well, I guess John's sort of like being ordained as the leader of the Night's Watch whilst others are missing is sort of like a bit of character development for John.
Yeah, yeah.
It is only temporary sounding, and
it was also the last sentence of the chapter.
Right. Yeah. So when we get to comparison with the TV show, I'll mention that I actually think the TV show had a clever change to what was going on here. I think they made some good decisions on the TV show about this particular part of the book.
All right, yeah, that's. I'll be interested to hear what you have to say. I guess one development is we see that even though Mance might have an enormous army and Castle Black is down to just a handful of the dregs of the Order, as John puts it in this chapter, that the Night's Watch still has home field advantage.
And, yeah,
it's an uphill, literally an uphill climb, for the wildlings to overcome this obstacle here.
Yeah, but and that goes to maybe why Mance wanted to get the Horn of
Jormund.
But again, I still question that because Mance knows what's coming,
right?
Putting a hole in the wall is not a great idea.
You know? Unless you could patch it up. Can you just put a person-sized hole in the wall?
Exactly. just it's like a laser beam.
Like one of those glass cutters.
So this chapter starts with a dream, and usually when we have dreams, I turn to you for their interpretation, but this didn't feel very prophetic, particularly this dream. It felt more revelatory of what John's thinking about. He doesn't belong. He's not really a Stark. And I thought the interesting part of it was when he's calling out to his brothers and his family and no one's answering. And then when he falls and it goes dark, he calls out for Ygritte. That's where he goes to. So it's kind of like...
Good observation.
He himself has changed who he most longs for.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He thinks... He sees this direwolf... right before the dream ends, and he thinks it's summer, and he wondering if it's signifying that the Thens found summer and killed the wolf. And John had been told at the end of the two John chapters ago, when he finally made it back to Castle Black, he had been told that Brandon Rickon had died, and he thought, no, that can't be. It's a mistake. Summer saved me at Queen's Crown. He's not saying this out loud, I don't think. I think he's just thinking it. But and so he had wondered if maybe some of Bran was alive inside of Summer, kind of like Oral and his eagle. And now he thinks, if Summer had died, then I've truly lost Bran forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, at one point, he thinks it might represent Ghost's death, but in fact, that he discounts that himself, because he said it looked more like Summer. It was the color of Summer, not the color of Ghost.
Both Grey Wind and Summer have similar physical characteristics. Summer is described as silver and smoke gray, and Grey Wind is described as smoke gray, and both have the golden eyes. So I can excuse him, especially if he's in a dark, in the crypts in the dark, to not be able to make out exactly which wolf it is. We know Summer is alive and well, at least the last time we checked on him. And we also know the Grey Wind is dead along with Robb. The Night's Watch don't know about the Red Wedding yet. So
John doesn't know. So the dream might be a little bit prophetic in the sense that it was Grey Wind in the crypts.
Yes, dead. Because one detail I think we've forgotten to mention is the wolf is bloody.
Yes, the wolf is bloody, yes.
So that's why he thinks maybe it's Summer having died. So yes, that was what I was getting at, that it's most likely Grey Wind, not Ghost, and John just doesn't know that Grey Wind is dead.
Good calls all.
Speaking of Ghost, John thinks to himself, Ghost, where are you? And he's had no connection with Ghost while he's been separated. There's been no wolf dreams or anything. And, we had discussed in the past that possibly the spells in the wall might be preventing such magical connections from passing through. But although that's possible, and there's got to be some reason why he's had no connection with Ghost, unless Ghost is dead. But the Three-Eyed Crow has created a connection with Bran, and Jojen is pretty sure the crow is north of the wall because they just pass through the wall. So,
but if the Three-Eyed Crow is older magic from before Bran the Builder's time, perhaps just throwing out ideas here.
Yes. And he could, the Three-Eyed Crow could also be a more advanced, capable person of using magic than John and Ghost, who are still kind of just sorting this stuff out.
Now, I want to noodle on a thing that we've talked about before when we've been in the North. I want to keep it reasonably short because it's going to be boring for people by now, but why are we even having this fight? So the wildlings aren't the enemy. The Night's Watch has seen enough now to know that the wildlings are not the true enemy. The wildlings, on the other hand, have shown that they are very determined to breach that wall. So that means the best case scenario for the Night's Watch is that they provide 100,000 fresh corpses for the burgeoning army of the dead. That's the best case scenario for the Night's Watch. It's not a great scenario, Now, previously, it would have been very difficult. So I've really been thinking about this. I've really been thinking about how I can solve this problem. Previously, it would have been very difficult to negotiate with the wildlings because they were too disparate. But Mance has brought them all together under one person. So it would be possible to have a negotiation which came to an agreement. And I actually thought of the terms of the agreement. Are you ready for them?
All right. Okay. First of all,
1,000 of your best men join the Night's Watch just for the winter. They're not full brothers. They don't have to stay. But for the winter, we have 1,000 of you helping us along the wall to protect the wall. At the end of the end of the winter, you can take the Black or you can go back north of the wall. Okay?
Okay.
Any people who want to can stay in and to help rebuild the castles along the wall. That should provide shelter for several thousand of them and also help to make the wall a bit more defensible because the castles would be manned and occupiable. Thirdly, the main body of the wildlings stick to the gifts, the gift and the new gift. Yeah, there are abandoned towns that they can rebuild. There's a lot of arable land that's currently not being farmed, presumably. They could occupy it without fighting. You don't steal from the people who already live there. And when the winter's over, you go back north.
I like all those I think if they could enforce all those rules, they...
And they that's tricky. Sense. I too think the enforcement one is the trickiest one, because the wildlings are wild and they won't want to be confined by these rules.
Yeah, and once you take that, once you take the toothpaste and put it on the southern side of the wall, it's hard to put it back into the tube on the northern side.
The one thing is, though, once the winter is over, I think the wildlings would want to go back north.
Because they don't want to kneel.
Because they don't want to kneel, you know?
Yeah. 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 So the assumption would be, and I think it's a solid assumption, the only reason they're looking to get south of the wall in mass is because they know right. what's coming.
Right. They're not afraid of the cold. These people are hardy.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's possible. I mean, I think everything you said would be logic, would be a good idea. It would be agreeable. It's just whether or not you can control, you can keep them within the gift. You can get them to do the things yeah. you want them
the other,
to do.
The other thing that would be tricky, of course, is one thing you'd want them to do is to farm the land and send provisions to the wall. And that might stick in the craw a little bit. And the other slight problem would be Mance himself, because Mance is a deserter of the Night's Watch.
Oh,
so allowing right. him back, by... that's not going to work. He himself, is yes. his life is forfeit.
By very rule, the fact that he's a deserter means his life... I guess maybe in the negotiations he could negotiate for immunity.
Possibly, but that's a tough pill. That would be a hard sell for John. You know, he saw what happened to Garrett, Will...
Garrett in our story.
Will in the TV show, yeah. Yeah. Never been able to pick that
it's
up.
It's very confusing. Yeah. I know.
All right, so that's it. So I'll stop complaining about them fighting the wildlings. They shouldn't do it.
Yeah, I think the one thing that, like the biggest issue that seems to be overlooked at the moment is the first thing you said. If they don't let them south of the wall, they're just adding 100,000 members to the other's right. army.
And you get the feeling that he complained that the 100,000 had a lot of women and children who wouldn't be very useful fighters. As whites come back from the dead, they might be quite useful. They may actually find right. their fighting yeah. game when they are already dead and don't care.
Yeah.
I shall say no more. I've made my points.
I know, yeah, I totally understand your point, and I think it's definitely something. I think probably the Night's Watch is just so used to fighting the wildlings that they have not stopped to think, is there an alternative
right.
here?
All of the magical creatures north of the wall are laughed about, that they don't even exist. You know, they've fallen into legend, into myth. But
well, I'm giants. If giants were laughable before tonight,
right.
they would not be right. afterward.
And John and anyone who survives the Great Ranging will have seen real horrors. You know.
Oh yeah, we know that. You know, several of them have made it back, and not a lot, but a handful of them. Dolores Ed, Gren, some of the others have made it back and have, told them what they saw. So. So John, when John is up on the wall and they're firing at the wildlings with the trebuchets and the arrows and everything, and he thinks to himself that Bowen Marsh left Castle Black well supplied in everything but men. You know, they have tons of arrows, well stacked rocks of various size, crates of oil and other incendiaries. So basically what I'm getting at is Bowen Marsh did what he knows. As Lord yes. Steward, he knows supplies and stock levels. So he made sure the castle had all supplies that they could want. Unfortunately, Bowen Marsh is not a battle commander. So he was easily duped by Mance into leaving Castle Black exposed and understaffed when he was fainting along the wall. And Bowen was sending people left and right to tend to those yeah. feints.
So. I do have to, I mean, just questioning Mance's tactics a little bit. I do wonder if he should, there's a gate wide enough for one horse through here. Sending all 100,000 at that gate is not helping anyone. They're just getting under each other's feet.
No.
You could attack every point. He knows there are other points where there's egress through the wall. He could be attacking every one of those simultaneously.
We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored by Audible. To get a free audiobook, or two if you're an Amazon Prime member, go to our exclusive URL, audibletrial.com/ghostsharrenhal. You can find the link in our show notes. Yeah, you know, they could, there's other ways of going about this. They didn't have to attack directly at Castle Black. He got raiders up over the wall. You know, Jarl personally didn't make it. We've talked about this before. They could have dropped ladders down and gotten more and more people over. Now, you're not going to get 100,000 people over, probably. But
for instance, if you send 50,000 at Castle Black, that's going to make all of the defenders collapse on Castle Black. Meanwhile, there are 50,000 of you creeping over the wall somewhere else.
Yes, in drips and drabs, but as long as you keep those 50,000 there and keep the attention on that location.
And slowly but surely whittle it down to 40,000, 30,000. Meanwhile, you've all climbed the wall.
There's one last guy waving around.
Just him on his mammoth.
His spear.
Doing a wheelie.
Yeah.
do you call it a wheelie when you're on a four-legged animal?
Probably
not a wheelie.
What is that called?
Like a...
Rearing up, right? Is that... Yeah. So, you know, one thing John wishes for is that they had more trebuchets and had built them on moving platforms. And I thought, right now they only have two working large trebuchets. I think they have some smaller ones, but only two working large ones. And one of them breaks in the middle of the battle. And I wondered if that was a sign of the Night's Watch wavering commitment to their duty, because they might not have... tons of men, but they have enough to fulfill that need.
Yeah.
You know, they had time and people enough that they could have put 50 trebuchets up there if they wanted to.
For hundreds of years, they fought back little raiding parties. A big trebuchet doesn't help with that. I mean, it fires a great big rock into the middle of the north of the wall and it lands. The chances of it hitting the eight guys who are attacking you are pretty slim. You know? Plus, if they just happen to be looking up, they could just take a step to the right, you know.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking along the same lines.
Really well against 100,000 in formation.
Right. I was thinking, you know, they're probably just tired of staring out at nothing, preparing as if a huge host will march against them that never appears. Meanwhile, the trebuchets are falling in disrepair, and they're like, oh, what is the matter? But, you know, I guess this was the matter.
I mean, think about it. You're up on that wall. You must fire, like, every time you go to the bathroom, you must put it in the trebuchet and just fire it off into the north just for the heck of it.
Just for fun. Just to use the trebuchet.
So John was surprised by how many mammoths there were, but he should have known, really. There were 100 mammoths, not a dozen. But where did they get them? If he didn't see them the first time around, have they been collecting mammoths on the way? Were all of the scouting parties for the main body of Mance's army riding mammoths? That seems a little bit not subtle.
Well, so one of the chapters, I can't remember which one it is off the top of my head, but it opens with John being in awe of the giants riding mammoths parade that's going by. And so I feel like he should have known how many giants and mammoths there were in this host, because he saw them firsthand and he rode with them and he commented on them. But, you know, as I thought about it, I guess he could have been unsure. He doesn't realize there's 100 mammoths until enough fire has spread. And then he's like, oh, there's not a dozen, there's 100. I guess he could have been unsure whether Mance congregated the whole host
here. That's true. And he says at various points that every time he'd seen the army before, it was strung out over miles of marching where you wouldn't see them all in one place. And you wouldn't, you know, every time you see a mammoth and a giant, they might look like the last mammoth and giant you saw, you know, so. He also didn't realize there was a game of mammoth giant polo going on behind the next hill, you know.
That would be interesting to watch.
So yeah, that's almost pedantry, but I think you're right. The emphasis is more on it's the middle of the night. He hasn't seen anything, and when the fire lands, he's like, God, there's hundreds of them, you know.
He brought them all. Yeah. You know. Mance did tell him and everyone who was listening when they arrived at the Fist that the battle, like if we get to Castle Black before Mormont does, the battle is won. So John knew the battle was coming to Castle Black, and that's what he was, you know, he was sounding the alarms. He was telling everybody, the battle is here, get Bowen Marsh back here. So he ultimately knew that this was the location of the battle, but I guess it just caught him off guard that there wasn't just a handful of mammoths. I just felt like I'm giving him a pass because of the fact that he can't have known that Mace concentrated them all. But when he saw all 100, I would have expected him to be like, oh, he brought the whole gang. You know, not, there's 100.
It would have actually been more interesting if he'd only seen a dozen and be like, where the hell are the rest of them? They're climbing the wall, aren't they? They're bringing mammoths up the wall.
So did you feel like Donald Noy brought a bit of a skeleton crew to defend the gate? Just him, two archers, and two spearmen.
Yeah, I think I would have taken a few more, for sure. I mean, just to have backups, you know? In fact, I would have taken at least two spares and one runner, because if the spares would started to be used, I would want the runner to run back up the wall and grab four more guys and bring them down, because I would want guys there the whole time, because it's the most important part of the battle. Yeah, you're right.
And I get they have light numbers. They're short in manpower.
The people on top of the 700-foot wall, you can afford to lose a few of those because there's nothing to do. You're 700 feet away.
Yes. As John tells them at the top of the wall when he's giving them the rah-rah speech, there's only one weak spot along the wall. It doesn't matter what the wildlings do to any other stretch of the wall. There is as you said, a horse's width of weak spot on this wall. So, you know, Donald Noy stopped Mag because they kind of killed each other and both died in each other's arms. If Mag had survived that fight, he would have just kept coming.
To stop him. The last of the defenders was gone. Right?
Yes. Yes. That's my point. Like, I get it's a narrow, tight quarters, but you probably should have brought maybe 10 men in case the first wave didn't succeed.
I mean, what I would have done if I was John, when the second trebuchet fell, I'd be like, you, trebuchet boys, get in that winch. Get down and help Donald Noy, you know.
Right.
You're not doing anything anymore. Good. Stop playing with your poop.
Good thinking.
So Noy gives John control of the wall when he goes down, and that's, you know, John kind of freezes on the occasion of it. Just the fact that he's in charge. But, you know, honestly, I think John would take that in his stride. He's used to bossing people around. It's not. He is. He's born to it.
Yeah. I'm sure it was surreal at first when he first was like, me? Why me? There's much more seasoned people here along the wall. But I felt like he did a good job. You know, he kept morale up. He put the threat in perspective for the men and created the defense plan and executed it.
Yeah.
And his plan, as you said, his point was right. I think you had mentioned this earlier. The men riding around down there, he specifically mentions the men riding around in chariots and running with spears and axes. They had no bearing on the people at the top of the wall. Well, they were just going to ride in circles or ride up to the wall and stop. You know, there's nothing they could do. And the fact that John pointed out, look, there's a absolutely enormous host out there. As far as the eye could see, there's people pretty much. But they can't do anything.
And John comments on their
John comments on their lack of discipline, that they're firing arrows into the wall. But I'm going to say that's not really a lack of discipline. That's just stupidity. If you fire an arrow and it falls 200 feet short of your target, then and actually falls back into your friends, then don't wait for your commander to explain this to you. Stop firing those arrows. It's stupid.
Right, yeah. Also, the battle lines fall apart almost immediately. That's one thing he notices. But, you know, Mance did a great job, pretty much almost an unheard of job, combining all the factions of wildlings, which is absolutely no easy task. But it's ultimately only half the battle. It's hard to teach any kind of discipline to this enormous group of factions and trying to get them to act as one.
Yeah.
He'd need a great deal of skilled battle commanders and a lot of training in order to get them.
Or an entirely different strategy. That would be the other thing he could do. Don't line up in battle formation when you don't have people who are capable of lining up in battle formation. Make this more of a guerrilla war, you know. Go in small groups.
Yeah.
Take, you know, the battering ram. I like the battering ram. That's good. You could do the battering ram over and over and over again. In small groups. You don't need to send mammoths that will run amok and kill everyone.
Yeah, that makes sense. If they just sent like four giants at a time with a battering ram over and over.
Maybe
again.
With a couple of like bodyguards to hold a sturdy umbrella over them.
Wooden umbrella.
Yeah. But on the subject of unseasoned, untrained rookies, the Night's Watch was supplemented by a few people still from Molestown, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Not many, though.
Not many. Most of them went back to their lives.
This is, I'm prompting you because when we say, when there's something like this in the notes, I figure you've got a list.
Well, so we get the mention of two adults and three orphan children. We get Harith, who they call Horse because he has big buck teeth, I guess. As John explains it to us. And Harith was one of the moles that came over when John said, get everyone to Castle Black. And he decided to stay. He was so impressed, he wanted to take the black.
Right.
So he's still there. There is Zay. I guess that's how you pronounce her name. Z-E-I, Zay. I'm going to go with that. She was the prostitute from Molestown. And she, last John chapter, turned out to be pretty handy with a crossbow, so she has stayed to fight. And then there's three young orphans that, as John puts it, Noi kept because nobody else wanted them. I'm not sure you can do that, just decide to keep children.
Well,
but I guess
in that situation you can, because literally nobody else wanted them.
Nobody else wanted them. Yes, and they were young. They were like between the ages of like 8 and 5 or something like that. But, you know, I wondered, was it wise for all of the Molestown people to figure everything's okay and go home?
Well, safer, apart from if you lose, if you lose the battle, of course, in which case, very unsafe.
Yes, yes, exactly. John knew Mance was coming. And, you know, you'd think that the Night's Watch would implore them to stay for his arrival, because, like you said, if they fail, the wildlings are going to come through and get to those Molestown people fast. And John told us that the castle was stocked well with everything but manpower. So, you know, they could have used help on the wall, firing arrows, burning pitch, loading the trebuchets.
Yeah.
So,
or being the runner to say we need more men down at the tunnel.
Right. Or shove those people through the tunnel. You go in first. Tell us what you see in there.
I've switched sides. Mag the Mighty. So John, with Aemon and Pip and Clarice, check on the gate. As we said, and Noi hadn't returned. He had died at the same time as Mag the Mighty. Before this battle, Noi had arranged to remove the southern side debris that had fallen when the stairs burned and fell. They'd blocked the entrance to the tunnel, and there was a sort of simple temptation to just leave it there because that would keep them out. But of course, you couldn't then defend the tunnel itself if you know. So basically, Mag the Mighty would have worked his way through to that debris, and then it's just a matter of time.
Yes, yeah, you can't leave the gate and the tunnel for the northern gate and the tunnel for the wildlings. I know it's a narrow bottleneck for sure, but it just leaves the inner gate and the debris. And as we've mentioned, this is the only weak spot on the wall. You must protect all of it. Yep. And it has built-in protections. John mentions there's murder holes in there, and I think we mentioned in the summary that there are three middle gates. So you protect every inch of that gate, every inch of that tunnel. You know, because once the wildlings do start pouring through, even though they'll only be pouring through a handful at a time, eventually
they'll come through.
They'll get absolutely. In, and it'll be.
They don't have 100,000 crossbow bolts to kill them all.
Yes, right, and. John mentions when he finds Noi dead, he and Mag the Mighty dead, John calls Mag the Mighty the King of Giants, which is not entirely true. Well, first of all, his Mag the Mighty's full name was Magmar Tunda Weg. That we learned that, I think, the last John chapter. But he wasn't actually the King of the Giants. Tormund told John that giants don't have kings, just like mammoths and snow bears don't have kings. He was more of like an elder, a leader that the other giants respected and looked up to because he was old and mighty.
Oh, I thought you were going somewhere with that. Okay, fine.
No, that was it. I just wanted to clarify when he called him the King of the Giants. I was like, well.
So we're left with a new generation of leadership at the wall, basically. John is clearly now in charge. If temporarily, perhaps, but he's in charge. And he himself left Gren in charge on top of the wall when he came down. So that's another newbie to the Night's Watch in a leadership position. And of course, Sam might get back one day. We know he would be a decent leader, if a little cowardly. So a whole new generation of leaders of the Night's Watch, it seems.
Yeah, at least until Beauan Marsh gets back. So we won't. You'd think, you know, they did signal the alarms for, you know, to bring everybody back that Beauan had spread out.
Tricky to get to the gate now, though. Coming through.
Aemon paints a nice picture of why Jon should lead, chosen by Donal Noy and Corin Halfhand before him. Mormont made him his steward, son of Winterfell, nephew of Benjen Stark. So he has an impressive resume, but he's also very young and very inexperienced.
But he's done things that most of the Night's Watch haven't done. He's ranged north of the wall. He's infiltrated an enemy camp. He's killed Corin Halfhand, which is not actually a good thing, but you know, he's broken his vows. Okay, some of this doesn't actually help him, but All right, well, do you have some background for us?
I sure do. So it's kind of background that we've talked about before, but it's been a long while, so I just kind of wanted to pay a quick tribute to our fallen Donal Noy. So we lost Donal Noy in this battle. The smith began his trade for the Baratheons at Storm's End. It was Noy who crafted Robert's famous warhammer that he killed Rhaegar with on the Trident.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Having lost his arm in Robert's rebellion during the awful siege of Storm's End, where Davos earned his moniker the Onion Knight, he left the service of the Baratheons and took the Black.
And Stannis earned his moniker as the blacksmith's arm eater.
If Davos lost fingers, what did Donald do? Noy was one of the first mentors for Jon at Castle Black. He is the one that explained to Jon that Jon was humiliating his fellow recruits when they fought, because these boys were untrained in fighting, unlike Jon, who had been trained by Roderick Cassell and, you know, had proper battle training, unlike these other boys who were just small folk who ended up at the wall for various reasons. Anyway, this led Jon to rethink the way he interacted with the boys and ultimately paved the path to creating friends out of foes. And for this and more, though Donal Noy is gone, he shall never be forgotten.
Indeed. So comparison with the television show. So as I mentioned last John chapter, this battle was pushed back a long way in the TV show. So most of this book has been season 3 of Game of Thrones. This battle was season 4, episode 9. So almost at the end of season 4. So almost an entire season after John escaped from the Wildlings.
Wow, okay.
I think the show did this all very well, because it made the two battles into one battle. Ygritte and Co. from the south, Mance's main force from the north. Also, Mance's tactics were more like I was describing there. They were far less wasteful. They weren't lining up the whole 100,000 and marching towards the wall like cannon fodder. They sent small groups of mammoths and giants to attack the gate.
Uh-huh. Good idea. Wish we had thought of that.
Exactly. John and friends did not spend the entire night shooting fish in a barrel. There was none of that exhaustion. And the TV battle, I think, was more realistic because of it, because there was a lot of boredom on the wall. Even though the battle was going on, they didn't have that much to do.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
They would repel them from the gate. They would wait. The next round would come. They would start fighting again. That's how it went.
Okay.
I will say that in the TV show, what they didn't get right is the same thing you were just arguing. You were just arguing they needed to send more troops down from the wall to protect the tunnel.
Yes.
In the TV show, they made the same mistake. They didn't have enough people defending Castle Black from the raiding party.
Okay.
The battle there was very, very close. Could have gone either way. And if they'd lost Castle Black...
Oh, it's over.
Then...
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
So the whole thing was on a knife edge because of that. Nobody actually gives John command, but the other commanders, who I won't mention their names because they might be spoilers, all leave the wall to defend the castle or, in certain cases, run and hide. And so he was left in charge de facto on top of the wall.
Good stuff. I like the differences. Those are...
Yeah. Plus it condensed it. It condensed it down from two storylines with two different battles into one storyline. And it was more interesting for it.
Sure. I can see that.
It was still slightly overdone. The battle did not need to go on as long as it did. But, you know.
So that wasn't one of George Martin's perfect episodes, I guess.
Well, not in my opinion, but, you know, hey. So Pedantry Corner, the only thing I have here, and I think it's important, it's pedantry we've had before. The blasting of the Night's Watch horn. There were two blasts to signify wildlings, okay? But then they were repeated.
Yes, right.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, I did.
There were four blasts. So I'm like, well, wait a minute. Is there a cadence to these blasts that, you know, so we make sure we...
Right, the right order?
Because...
That was four.
Right, because there were
four.
Two. There was a gap and then there were two more. I was like, is there something worse than others, perhaps?
Or could they think, well, they did three and started over with both rangers returning and others approaching?
Yeah,
there's three
we've
and
had
one.
This problem before. Yeah, people, yeah.
Everybody's confused and running around.
So in news and notes, it says birthday, but are you just telling everyone that it's your birthday tomorrow?
It is not my birthday today. It is my birthday tomorrow. That is true.
Uh-huh.
Today is another almost equally important birthday.
It's not mine.
The birthday of George R.R. Martin.
Oh, he's only 47.
He is only 47. That's right. So he's got plenty of time to finish these final two books.
Thanks goodness.
He's actually 75.
Oosh.
So, yes, we wish him a happy birthday, and maybe for his birthday
present
he could, you know, write some pages or something.
Mm. Too much to ask. Please go out and rate and review us on Apple or anywhere else, but Apple in particular. We're, like we said last week, we are suffering on that platform because we don't have enough reviewers. So if you could leave us a rate and review on Apple, that would be great.
Yes, that would be fantastic. We'd greatly appreciate that. And don't forget to check out or buy me a coffee site. Check out our current tiers, because we have been in discussions about new tiers on our page and new offerings that we might include. So if you like what you see there, get locked in. It won't mean that you won't get any of the new stuff. It just means you will get the stuff that's on there right now at the price
yes.
that it's at right now. We certainly wouldn't do that to you. We wouldn't have you lock in and then be like, oh, but now here's all this new cool stuff that you don't get. We would never do that to you.
Let's draw a line to this one. Let's draw some conclusions.
Well, one thing we learned in this chapter is that you can do a lot with a little when you've got 700 feet of ice on your side.
Good point. Yes, exactly. And you can do it from quite safe locations, basically, on top of that 700 feet of ice.
Yes. And as John pointed out...
Oh, one other difference on the TV show. The giants had giant bow and arrows, and they could hit the top of the wall.
Oh.
So there was a little bit of peril.
Yeah.
Just occasionally, a giant-sized arrow would come flying up through the thing. One guy gets hit in the chest and is flown halfway to Molestown where he lands. You know.
Oh, wow. I had forgotten about that. That is that's another whole other level of issues there. Mm-hmm.
It certainly made it a little bit more exciting to be on top of the wall when that was going on. If you're just watching arrows fall 200 feet below you, it's like... Mm.
Well, Spare Boot did get struck in the wooden leg with an arrow.
He did.
He's the only person
one
that
reached...
got hit.
Yeah.
But ultimately, what we know is that the wall defends itself with a little help from some friends.
Oh, but let me just tell you one other thing that happened in the TV show. Sorry to just sort of like be piling on this. They sent climbers up the wall as well. But this was a strange decision by Mansrady.
Yeah.
So people climbed the wall while... I mean, I guess you try and sort of distract, you know... He must have forgotten about this huge thing they had. They had this great big weight on a chain that was held horizontal.
Oh,
and
no.
At any point, they pulled a pin out, and this thing swept down in a big sort of like, oh, just wiped out everyone who was climbing up the wall in one fell swoop. So Mance probably sent people he didn't like on that particular
Right,
mission.
Yeah. It was like a windshield wiper.
Exactly. That's what it did. Yeah, it... It smeared
them. Just takes everybody off.
So the wildling host has been turned back, but obviously it's not yet defeated. You can't imagine them going back to their homes.
Right, yeah. But, you know...
But what can they do?
Yeah,
They've
right.
got to get through that gate. That's the only thing they can do. But, I mean, they're going to lose a lot of people trying to get there. If Mag the Mighty can only get partway through the gate, then how are the rest of them going to get any further?
Yeah.
Other than by negotiation, just saying.
That is one way to do it, yeah. You know, John is walking around north of the wall at the end of the chapter, so they've clearly pushed back the first wave of attack.
Or at least the first wave has retreated out of range.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I can't imagine that they'll be like, well, that didn't work. Oh, well.
Right.
You know? I'm sure they'll be back for more. But this first wave has been repelled, and hopefully they can patch up the hole that you know, was left when the gate was destroyed and the first inner gate was destroyed. Hopefully they can get enough debris and stuff in there to make it harder for them
to
get
past. The
thing
about debris on the outside of the locked gates is they can clear that. I mean,
right.
If it's just a pile of debris, that's an easy thing to clear. It'll take time, but it won't take that much time.
Yeah, you know? And I guess it is better than not doing that, though, and just leaving the second inner gate exposed.
Perhaps, but these are metal gates that you can fire through, so you could just put your archers there and have them firing away all day at the invaders. If there's debris in the way, you can't do that.
Yeah, I think I'd personally still rather at least slow them down with the debris if possible.
I think you'd be better off trying to seal the breach in that gate, in the one that Magna Mighty tore. He pulled it apart so he could get through.
Yeah.
Seal that breach somehow. Find a way to seal that breach. And then you're back to three gates. You've lost the outer door.
Right.
But three gates is better than two gates and a pile of debris.
Yeah. I could see that logic. I could see three gates being better than two in debris.
So John is in charge at Castle Black. He didn't seem like he saw it coming, but he probably should have done. He was born to leadership. Sam himself, when John was appointed to the steward, Sam pointed it out that very day that he was being groomed for leadership.
Right.
That was the reason he was chosen.
John didn't see it that day, that's for sure.
No, and his rise has been meteoric from that point onwards. But again, he has done extraordinary things in his time in the Night's Watch compared to most of them.
Yeah. Now, he probably won't be in charge for long. Like I said, Bowen Marsh has to come back fairly soon. But, you know, it should be interesting to see how he handles this job and how others respond to him being put in this job.
There are a couple of other in the wind people who might come back to threaten his position. One is Alistair Thorne.
I was just going to mention him. Yes. Yes. Yeah, thankfully, he's not there right now to make trouble.
Right. But he was in King's Landing last we saw him, trying to convince them to send more help to, right. to the Night's Watch. And the other one, of course, is our old friend Janice Slint.
He's on his way, too. Now, you know, maybe he and John will become fast friends. And, you know, he could talk about, you know, they could talk about how Ned helped Slint in the Night's Watch by sending some of the Stark men to help patrol the city and such. And, maybe not. Maybe not.
Not really. Yep. Who have we got next week?
Well, next week, all I'll say is we have a character who last time we saw this character, it was unsure whether said character was left dead or alive.
We've never had a Joffrey POV before. No, he's definitely dead.
Okay. Beric Dondarrion POV? Could we be getting Beric 1?
He's definitely both. All right. There's four ways that you can help us. You could leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review, particularly on Apple Podcasts. That would be great. You could buy merchandise from us at ghostsofharrenhal.threadless.com. You could buy us a cup of Arbor Gold, which I've got a parched throat. I could do with one. at buymeacoffee.com/ghostsharrenhal, or become a sustainer at the Lord Paramount or Knight of the Realm level while they still exist. And get yourself locked into those tiers. Or you could just donate directly to our cause through ghostsofharrenhal.buzzsprout.com.
Well, if you're looking for more ways to interact with us and keeping up on the latest Ghosts of Harrenhal news and developments, well, you can always check us out on our social medias. You can follow us on Twitter at Ghost Harrenhal. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Discord, and YouTube.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.